Random House Audio presents The Dead in Their Vaulted Arches, a Flavia Deleuze novel, by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. The marble tombs that rise on high, whose dead in vaulted arches lie, whose pillars swell with sculptured stones, arms, angels, epitaphs, and bones, these, all the poor remains of state, adorn the rich or praise the great, who while on earth in fame they live, are senseless of the fame they give. Thomas Parnell, A Night Piece on Death, 1721. Prologue.
Your mother has been found.
Nearly a week after he had made it, Father's shocking announcement was still ringing in my ears. Harriet! Harriet found! Who could believe it? Harriet, who had been lost in a mountaineering accident when I was barely a year old. Harriet, whom I can't remember seeing, ever, with my own eyes. My reaction? Numbness, I'm afraid. Sheer, stupid, silent numbness. Not joy, not relief. Not even gratitude to those who had found her more than 10 years after her disappearance in the Himalayas. No, I felt only a cold numbness, a cold, shameful sort of numbness that made me need desperately to be alone. Chapter 1. To begin with, it was a perfect English morning, one of those dazzling days in early April when a new sun makes it seem suddenly like full-blown summer. Sunshine broke through the fat white dumplings of the clouds, sending shadows chasing one another playfully across the green fields and up into the gently rolling hills. Somewhere in the woods, on the other side of the railway line, a nightingale was singing.
"It's like a coloured plate from Wordsworth," my sister Daphne said, almost to herself. "Far too picturesque."
Ophelia, my oldest sister, was a still, pale, silent shadow, lost in her own thoughts. At the appointed time, which happened to be 10 o'clock, we were all of us gathered more or less together on the little railway platform at Buckshaw Holt. I think it was the first time in my life I had ever seen Daffy without a book in her hand. Father, who stood a bit apart from us, kept glancing every few minutes at his wristwatch and looking along the track, eyes squinting, watching for smoke in the distance. Directly behind him stood Dogger. How odd it was to see these two men, gentleman and servant, who had been through such ghastly times together, standing dressed in their Sunday best at an abandoned country railway station. Although Buckshaw Holt had once been used to bring both goods and guests to the great house, and although the rails remained, the station proper, with its weathered bricks, had been boarded up for donkey's years. In the past few days, though, it had been hurriedly made ready for Harriet's homecoming, swept out and tidied up, its broken window panes replaced, the tiny flower bed weeded and planted with a small riot of flowers. Father had been asked to go up to London and ride with her back to Buckshaw, but he had insisted on being at the little station at Buckshaw Holt to meet the train. It was, after all, he had explained to the vicar, the place and manner in which he had first met her all those many years ago when both of them were young. As we waited, I noticed that Father's boots had been polished to a high-gloss perfection, from which I deduced that Dogger was currently in a much improved state. There were times when Dogger screamed and whimpered in the night, huddled in the corner of his tiny bedroom, visited by the ghosts of far-off prisons, tormented by the devils of the past. At all other times, he was as competent as any human is capable of being, and I sent up thanks that this morning was one of them. Never had we needed him more. Here and there on the platform, small tight knots of villagers, keeping a respectful distance, talked quietly to one another, preserving our privacy. More than a few of them stood huddled closely round Mrs. Mallet, our cook, and her husband Alf, as if doing so made them, by some magic, part of the immediate household. As 10 o'clock approached, everyone, as if at an arranged signal, fell suddenly quiet, and an unearthly hush settled upon the countryside. It was as though a bell jar had been lowered upon the land, and all the world was holding its breath. Even the nightingale in the woods had abruptly ceased its song. The very air on the station platform was now electric, as it often becomes when a train is approaching, but not yet in sight. People shifted uneasily from foot to foot, and the faint wind of our collective breathing made a soft sigh on the gentle English air. And then, finally, after what seemed like an eternal stillness, we saw in the distance the smoke from the engine. Nearer and nearer it came, bringing Harriet, bringing my mother, home. The breath seemed sucked from my lungs as the gleaming engine panted into the station and squealed to a stop at the edge of the platform. It was not a long train, not more than an engine and half a dozen carriages, and it sat resting for a few moments in the importance of its own swirling steam. There was an odd little lull. Then a guard stepped down from the rear carriage and blew 3 sharp blasts on a whistle. Doors opened, and the platform was suddenly swarming with men in uniform. Military men with a dazzling array of full medals and clipped moustaches. They formed up quickly into 2 columns and stood stiffly at attention. A tall, tanned man I took to be their leader, his chest a wall of decorations and coloured ribbons, marched smartly to where Father stood and brought his arm up in a sharp salute that left his hand vibrating like a tuning fork. Although he seemed in a daze, Father managed a nod. From the remaining carriages poured a horde of men in black suits and bowler hats carrying walking sticks and furled umbrellas. Among them were a handful of women in severe suits, hats and gloves. A few even were in uniform. One of these, a fit but forbidding woman in RAF colours, looked such a tartar and had so many stripes on her sleeve that she might have been an air vice marshal. This little station at Buckshaw Holt, I thought, in all of its long history, had never before been so packed with such an assortment of humanity. To my surprise, one of the suited women turned out to be Father's sister, Aunt Felicity. She hugged Feely, hugged Daffy, hugged me, and then without a word took up her station beside Father. At an order, the 2 columns marched smartly towards the head of the train as the large door in the luggage van slid open. It was difficult, in the bright daylight, to make out anything in the dim depths of the van's interior. All I could see at first was what seemed to be a dozen white gloves dancing suspended in the darkness. And then gently, almost tenderly, a wooden box was handed out to the double column of waiting men, who shouldered it and stood motionless for a moment, like wooden soldiers staring straight ahead into the sunshine. I couldn't take my eyes off the thing. It was a coffin, which, once clear of the shadows of the luggage van, gleamed cruelly in the harsh sunlight. In it was Harriet. Harriet, my mother. Chapter 2. What did I think? How did I feel? I wish I knew. Sadness, perhaps, that our hopes were dashed forever. Relief that Harriet had come home at last. It should have been dull black, her coffin. It should have had frosty silver fittings, with covered urns and cherubs with downcast eyes. But it did not. It was of rich oak, polished to such an obscene brilliance that it hurt my eyes.
I found that I could not look at the thing. Oddly enough, the scene which popped into my mind was that one at the end of Mrs. Nesbit's novel, The Railway Children, in which Bobby, on the station platform, flings herself into the arms of her wrongfully imprisoned daddy. But there was to be no such tender ending for me, or, for that matter, for Father, or Feely, or Daffy either. No, there was to be no such happy conclusion. I glanced quickly at Father, as if he might give me a clue, but he too stood frozen in his own private glacier, beyond all grief and beyond all expression, as the coffin was draped with a Union Jack. Alf Mullet snapped a sharp salute and held it for a very long time. Daffy gave my ribs a dig with her elbow and pointed with the faintest inclination of her chin. At the south end of the platform, a rather stout old gentleman in a dark suit was standing apart from the others. I recognized him instantly. As the bearers moved slowly away from the train, bent under their sad burden, he removed his black hat in respect and lowered it to his side. It was Winston Churchill. Whatever could have brought the former Prime Minister to Bishop's Lacey? He stood there alone, watching in the deadly hush as my mother was carried to the open doors of a motor hearse, which had appeared in uncanny silence as if from nowhere. Churchill watched as the coffin, preceded by an officer with a drawn sword, was borne gently past Father, past Feely, past Daffy, and past me, then placed himself shoulder to shoulder with Father.
"She was England, damn it," he growled.
As if awakening from a dream, Father's eyes lifted, came to rest, and focused on Churchill's face. After a very long time, he said,
"She was more than that, Prime Minister."
Churchill nodded and seized Father's elbow.
"We can ill afford to lose a de Luce, Haviland," he said quietly.
What did he mean by that? For a moment, they stood there together in the old sunshine, these two seemingly defeated men, brothers in something far beyond me, something I could not even begin to imagine. Then, having shaken hands with Father, with Feely, with Daffy, and even with Aunt Felicity, Mr. Churchill came over to where I was standing, a little apart from the others.
"And have you also acquired a taste for pheasant sandwiches, young lady?"
Those words. Those exact words. I had heard them before. No, not heard them. Seen them. The roots of my hair were suddenly standing on tiptoe. Churchill's blue eyes were piercing, as if he were staring into my soul. What did he mean? What on earth was he suggesting? What was he expecting me to say? I'm afraid I blushed. It was all I could manage. Mr. Churchill stared intently into my face, taking my hand and giving it a gentle squeeze with his remarkably long fingers. "Yes," he said at last, almost as if to himself.
"Yes, I do believe you have."
And with that, he turned and walked away from me along the platform, acknowledging, with solemn nods to the left and to the right, the recognition of the villagers as he slowly made his way through them to his waiting car. Although he had been out of office for ages, there was still a remarkable air of greatness about this plump little man with his bulldog face and the startling stare of his great blue eyes. Daffy was already whispering in my ear.
"What did he say?" she asked.
"He said that he was sorry," I lied. I didn't know why, but I knew that it was the thing to do. "Just that he was sorry." Daffy gave me that squinty, evil look of hers. How could it be, I wondered, that with our mother lying dead under our very noses, two sisters could be almost at each other's throats over a simple fib? It seemed ridiculous, but it was happening. I can only suppose
that that's the way life is. And death. What I did know for certain was that I needed to get home, that I needed to be locked in the silence of my own room. Father was busy shaking hands with all the people who wanted to give him their condolences. The very air was alive with the reptilian hissing of their S's and the little animal squeals of their Y's.
"Sorry, Colonel Deluce, sorry, sorry," they were telling him over and over again, each in his or her own turn. It's a wonder Father didn't go mad on the spot. Could no one think of anything original to say?
Taffy once told me that there are approximately 500,000 words in the English language. With so many to choose from, you'd think that just one person, at least, could find something more original than that stupid word sorry. That's what I was thinking when a tall man in a coat, too long and much too heavy for such a lovely day, detached himself from the crowd on the platform and made directly for me.
"Mr. Luce?" he asked, in a surprisingly gentle voice.
I was not accustomed to being addressed as Mr. Luce. It was a name usually reserved for Daffy or Feely, or for Aunt Felicity.
"I am Flavia Deluce," I said, "and you are?"
It was a response Dogger had taught me to give automatically when spoken to by strangers. I glanced over and saw Dogger hovering solicitously at Father's side.
"A friend," the man said. "Just a friend of the family. I need to talk to you."
"I'm sorry," I said, taking a step backwards. "I'm..."
"Please, it's vitally important."
"Vitally?" Anyone who used the word vitally in everyday conversation could hardly be a villain.
"Well," I said, wavering.
"Tell your father that the gamekeeper is in jeopardy. He'll understand. I must speak to him. Tell him that the Nide is under..."
The man's eyes widened suddenly in puzzlement. Or was it horror, as he looked over my shoulder? What, or whom, had he seen?
"Come along, Flavia, you're keeping everyone waiting."
It was Feely. My sister gave the stranger a tight, polite smile as she put a hand on my shoulder and gave it an unnecessarily hard tug.
"Wait," I said, ducking to one side and breaking away from her grip. "I'll be there in a minute."
Dogger was already holding open the door of Harriet's old Rolls-Royce Phantom II, which he had parked as close to the platform as he possibly could. Father was halfway to the car, shuffling alarmingly, his head bowed. It was not until that moment, I think, that I realized what a crushing blow this whole business must be to him. He had lost Harriet, not once, but twice.
"Flavia!"
It was Feely again, her eyes bugging with cold blue impatience.
"Why," she hissed, "must you always insist on being such a..."
A shriek from the engine's whistle blotted out her last few words, but I was easily able to lip-read their shocking shape. The train began to move, slowly at first. We had been told, during our briefing by the undertakers, that as we departed the station, the train would be taken to a disused railway yard somewhere north of East Finching, to be turned round for its return run up to London. It was a breach of undertaking etiquette, as well as being uncommon bad luck, according to Mr. Sowerby of Sowerby and Sons, to run a funeral train backwards. By now, Feely was dragging me, literally, towards the waiting rolls. I tried to break free, but it was no use. Her fingers dug deeply into the muscle of my upper arm, and I was dragged, stumbling along, gasping in her wake. A sudden shout broke from among the stragglers at the station. I thought at first it was Feely's cruel treatment of me that had caused the outcry. But I saw now that people were running towards the edge of the platform. The guard's whistle was blowing frantically. Someone was screaming, and the engine banged to an abrupt halt with clouds of steam billowing out from beneath its driving wheels. I struggled free of Feely's grasp and elbowed my way back along the carriages, squeezing past the possible air vice marshal, who seemed rooted to the spot. The villagers stood transfixed, many hands clapped to many mouths.
"Someone pushed him," said a woman's voice from somewhere behind me in the crowd.
At my feet, as if reaching for my shoes, a human hand stuck stiffly out, with awful stillness, from beneath the wheels of the last carriage. I knelt down for a closer look. The newly filthy fingers were wide open, reaching for help that would never arrive. On the wrist, which was almost indecently naked, tiny golden hairs stirred gently in the moving air beneath the train. My nostrils filled with the smell of hot, oily steam, and with something else, a sharp, coppery odour, which once experienced is never forgotten. I recognised it at once. It was the smell of blood. Shoved up nearly to the dead elbow was the still buttoned cuff of a coat too long and much too heavy for such a lovely day. Chapter 3. The rolls crept along the lane at a snail's pace behind the hearse. Even though Buckshaw Holt was little more than a mile from the house, I knew already that this sad journey was going to take simply ages. The analytical part of my brain wanted to make sense of what I had just witnessed on the railway platform. The violent death of a stranger beneath the wheels of the train. But a wilder, more primitive, more reptilian force would not allow it, throwing up excuses that seemed reasonable enough at the time.
"These precious hours belong to Harriet," it was telling me. "You must not steal them from her. You owe it to the memory of your mother." Harriet. Think only of Harriet, Flavia. It is her due.
I let myself sink back into the comforting leather of the seat and allowed my mind to fly back to that day, last week, in my laboratory. Their drowned faces are not so white and fishy as you might expect, floating barely beneath the surface in the blood-red light. They are, in fact, rather the colour of rotted roses. She still smiles in spite of all that has happened. He wears a shockingly boyish expression upon his face. Beneath them, coiled like tangled tentacles of seaweed, black ribbons dangle down into the liquid depths. I touch the surface, write their initials in the water with my forefinger. H.D.L. So closely are this man and this woman tied together that the same three letters stand for them both. Harriet Deluce and Haviland Deluce, my mother and my father. It was odd, really, how I had happened upon these images. The attics at Buckshaw are a vast aerial underworld, containing all the clatter, the cast-offs, the debris, the dumpings, the sad dusty residue of all those who have lived and breathed in this house for centuries past. Piled on top of the mouldering prayer chair, for instance, upon which the terrible-tempered Georgina Deluce had once perched piously in her powdered periwig, to hear the whispered confessions of her terrified children, was the crumpled wreckage of the home-built glider in which her ill-fated grandson, Leopold, had launched himself from the parapets of the east wing scant seconds before coming to grief on the steel-hard frozen ground of the Visto, bringing to an abrupt end that particular branch of the family. If you looked carefully, you could still see the stains of Leopold's oxidized blood on the glider's frail, linen-covered wings. In another corner, stacked in a stiff spinal curve, a pile of china chamber pots still gave off their faint but unmistakable pong in the tired, stuffy air. Tables, chairs, and chimney pieces were squeezed in cheek by jowl with ormolu clocks, glazed Greek vases of startling orange and black, unwanted umbrella stands, and the sad-eyed head of an indifferently stuffed gazelle. It was to this shadowy graveyard of unwanted bric-a-brac that I had fled instinctively last week after Father's shocking announcement. To the attics I had flown, and there, to keep from thinking, I had crumpled into a corner, reciting mindlessly one of those shreds of childhood nonsense which we fall back on in times of great stress, when we can't think what else to do. A was an archer who shot at a frog. B was a butcher who had a black dog. C was a crier. I wasn't going to bloody well cry. No, I bloody well wasn't. Instead of archers and criers, I would distract my mind by rehearsing the poisons. A is for arsenic, hid in a spud. B is for bromate that buggers the blood. I was up to C is for cyanide when a slight movement caught my eye, a sudden scurrying that vanished swiftly behind a crested French armoire. Was it a mouse? Perhaps a rat. I shouldn't be at all surprised. The attics of Buckshaw are, as I have said, an abandoned dumping ground, where a rat would be as much at home as I was. I got slowly to my feet and peeked carefully behind the armoire. But whatever it had been was gone. I opened one of the dark doors of the monstrosity, and there they were, the smart black carrying cases, two of them, shoved into the far corners of the armoire, almost as if someone hadn't wanted them to be found. I reached in and dragged the matching containers out of the shadows and into the half-light of the attic. They were covered in pebbled leather with shiny nickel-plated snaps, each case with its own key, which hung, fortunately, from the carrying handles by a bit of ordinary butcher's string. I popped open the first box and swung back the lid. I knew at once by its metallic crackle finish and the way in which its mechanical octopus arms were folded into their fitted plush compartments that the machine I was looking at was a cine projector. Mr. Mitchell, proprietor of Bishop's Lacey Photographic Studio, owned a similar device with which he occasionally exhibited the same few tired old films at St. Tancred's Parish Hall. His machine was larger, of course, and was equipped with a loudspeaker for the sound. Once, during a particularly dreary repeat showing of The Paper Wasp and Its Vespiaries, I had whiled away the time by inventing riddles, one of which I thought rather clever. Why is a House of Commons like a cine sound projector? Because they both have a speaker. I could hardly wait to tell it at the breakfast table. But that had been in happier times. I fingered the snap and opened the second box. This one contained a matching device, smaller, with a clockwork crank on its side and several lenses mounted in a rotating turret on its snout. A cine camera. I lifted the thing to my face and peered through the viewfinder, moving the camera slowly from right to left, as if I were filming. Buckshaw, I intoned in a newsreel voice. Ancestral home of the family de Luce since time immemorial. A house divided, a house apart. I put the camera down rather abruptly, and rather roughly, I'm afraid. I did not feel like going on with this. It was then that I noticed, for the first time, the little gauge on its body. The indicator needle was calibrated from 0 to 50 feet, and it stood nearly, but not quite, at the end of its range. There was still film in the camera, even after all these years. And if I were any judge, about 45 feet of it had been exposed. Exposed, but never developed. My heart lunged suddenly into my throat, trying to escape. I nearly choked on it. If my suspicions were correct, this film, this camera, might well contain hidden images of my dead mother, Harriet.
Within the hour, having made my preparations, I was in my chemical laboratory in Buckshaw's abandoned East Wing. The lab had been constructed and outfitted towards the end of the Victorian era by the father of Harriet's uncle, Tarquin de Luce, for a son whose spectacular collapse at Oxford was still, even after more than half a century, only whispered about among those dreaming spires. It was here in this sunny room at the top of the house that Uncle Tar had lived, worked, and eventually died, his research into the first-order decomposition of nitrogen pentoxide having led, or so it had been hinted, to the destruction in Japan 6 years ago of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I had happened upon this kingdom of abandoned and glorious glassware some years ago during a rainy day exploration of Buckshaw, and promptly claimed it as my own. By poring over his notebooks and duplicating many of the experiments in my late uncle's remarkable library, I had managed to make of myself a more than competent chemist. My specialty was not, though, the pentoxide of nitrogen, but rather the more traditional poisons. I pulled the cine camera from under my jumper, where I had stuffed it, just in case, in my descent from the attics, I had been intercepted by one of my sisters. Phoebe had turned 18 in January, and would be, for just a short while longer, 7 years older than me. Daffy, with whom I shared a birthday, would soon be 14, while I was now almost 12. In spite of being sisters, we were none of us what you would call great friends. We were still working out new ways to torture one another. In the small photographic darkroom at the far end of the laboratory, I reached for a brown glass bottle on the shelf. Metol, it said on the label in Uncle Tar's unmistakable spidery handwriting. Metol, of course, was nothing more than a fancy name for plain old monomethylpaminophenol sulfate. I had skimmed through the dark-stained pages of a photo reference manual and found that what needed to be done with the film was actually quite straightforward. First step was the developer. I groaned as I pulled the stopper from the bottle and decanted a sample into a beaker. 20 years on the shelf had taken its toll. The metol had oxidized and become an acrid brown sludge, the colour of last night's coffee grounds. My groan turned slowly to a grin. "Do we have any coffee?" I asked, strolling into the kitchen with an air of pretended boredom.
"Coffee?" Mrs. Mullet asked.
"What you want with coffee? Coffee's no good for girls. Gives you the collie wobbles like.
I thought that if someone came to call, it would be nice to offer them a cup.
You'd think I'd ask for champagne."
"And who was you expecting, miss?"
"Tita," I lied. Tita Schrantz was a German ex-prisoner of war from Culverhouse Farm who had recently become engaged to Feely.
"Never mind," I told Mrs. M. "If he comes, he'll have to settle for tea. Do we have any biscuits?"
"In the pantry," she said. "That nice tin with Windsor Castle on the lid."
I gave her an idiotic grin and popped into the pantry. At the back of a high shelf, just as I had remembered, was a bottle of Maxwell House ground coffee. In spite of the rationing, it had been brought as a gift from the nearby American air base at Leithcote by Carl Pendracker, another of Feely's admirers, who, in spite of father's belief that Carl was of the bloodline of King Arthur, had been unhorsed in the recent matrimonial sweepstakes. Offering up a silent prayer of thanks for the general bagginess of old-fashioned clothing, I shoved the coffee under one side of my sweater, stuffed a large wire kitchen whisk under the other, clamped a couple of Empire biscuits between my teeth, and made my escape.
"Thanks, Mrs. M," I mumbled around the mouthful of biscuits, keeping my hunched back to her.
Safely back upstairs in my laboratory, I emptied the coffee into a cone-shaped paper filter, placed it in a glass funnel, and lighting a Bunsen burner, waited for the distilled water in the tea kettle to come to the boil. Chemically speaking, I remembered, the developing of film was simply a matter of reducing its silver halide crystals through deoxidation to the basic element, silver. If methol would do the job, I reasoned, so would caffeine. And so, for that matter, would vanilla extract, although I knew that if I absconded with Mrs. Mullet's vanilla extract, she'd have my guts for garters. The hoarded coffee was a much safer bet. When the water had boiled for 2 minutes, I measured out 3 cups and poured it over the coffee. It smelled almost good enough to drink. I stirred the brown liquid to break up the bubbles and foam, and when it had cooled sufficiently, stirred in 7 teaspoons of sodium carbonate. Good old, jolly old washing soda. The initially welcoming coffee aroma was now changing, the stench increasing by the second. To be perfectly honest, it now smelt as if a coffee house in the slums of hell had been struck by lightning. I was happy to be able to leave the room, even if only for a few minutes. One more quick trip to the attics to retrieve the enamel bedpan I had spotted among the Deleuze family relics, and I was nearly ready to proceed. That being done, I gathered up my equipment and locked myself into the dark room. I switched on the safe light. There was a brief red flash, a tiny pop. Oh no, the blasted bulb had blown out. I opened the door and set out in search of a new one. There were times when we grumbled about the fact that Father had ordered Dogger to replace most of the bulbs at Buckshaw with 10-watt substitutes in order to save on electricity. The only one of us who didn't seem to mind was Feely, who needed only a dim and feeble light to write in her diary and to examine her spotty hide in the looking-glass. "Low wattage wins wars," she said, even though the war had been over for 6 years. "And besides, it's so much more romantic." So I had no difficulty deciding which bulb to pinch. Before you could count to 87, I know that for a fact, because I counted in my head, I was back in the laboratory with the bulb from Feely's bedside lamp, as well as the bottle of Where's the Fire nail varnish, with which she had recently taken to uglifying her fingers. To my mind, if nature had wanted us to have bright red fingertips, she would have caused us to be born with our blood on the outside. I painted the bulb with the varnish, blew wolfish huffs and puffs of air onto it until it was dry, then gave it a second coat, making sure that the surface of the glass was completely covered with the ruby lacquer. With the critical job I was about to undertake, I couldn't afford the slightest leakage of white light. Again, I latched myself into the dark room. I clicked on the switch and was rewarded with a dim red glow. Perfect. I gave the crank on the side of the camera a bit of a wind-up and pushed the button. There was a clattering whir as the film inside jerked into motion. After no more than about 10 seconds, the end of the ribbon went through and flapped lazily on the spool. I undid the snap, opened the side of the camera, and removed the 4-reel. Now came the tricky part. I wound the film one slow turn at a time, off the reel and onto the wire whisk, securing it at each end with a paper clip. I had already half-filled the bedpan with my coffee developer, and into this I dipped the whisk, turning it ever so slowly, slowly, like a chicken on a spit. The thermometer in the coffee bath was spot on at 68 degrees Fahrenheit. The 12 minutes recommended by the photo manual went by like flowing sludge. As I waited with one eye on the clock, I remembered that in the early days of photography, film had been developed with gallic acid, C7H6O5, which was obtained in small percentage from oak apples, those tumours that grew on the twigs and branches of the gall, or dyer's oak, wherever they had been punctured by the gall fly in laying its eggs. Oddly enough, those same galls, dissolved in water, had also once been used as an antidote to strychnine poisoning. How pleasant it was to reflect that without the female gallfly, we might never have had either photography or a convenient means of saving one's rich Uncle Neddy from the hands of a would-be killer. But would this film I had found in the camera have retained its latent images? Interesting, wasn't it? That one word, latent, was used to describe the invisible, undeveloped forms and shapes on photographic film, as well as yet invisible fingerprints. Would the film show anything at all? Or rather, just the wet, grey, disappointing fog that might well have resulted from too many baking summers and freezing winters in the attic? I watched, fascinated, as at my very fingertips, hundreds of tiny negative images began to form, fading into existence, as if from nowhere, as if by magic. Each frame of the film was too small to guess at its content. Only when the film was fully processed would its secrets, if any, be revealed. 12 minutes had now passed, and still the images did not yet seem to be fully developed. The coffee developer was obviously slower acting than Meatall. I would keep up my twirling of the whisk until the images seemed as dark as a normal negative. Another 12 minutes went by, and I was beginning to flag. When it comes to chemistry, impatience is not a virtue. Half an hour is far too long to engage in any activity, even one that's enjoyable. By the time the images seemed satisfactory, I was ready to scream. But I wasn't finished yet, far from it. This was merely the first step. Now came the first wash, 5 minutes under running water. Waiting was agony. I could hardly resist the urge to load the partly processed film into the projector and hang the consequences. And then the bleach. I had already mixed a 1/4 teaspoon of potassium permanganate into 1/4 of water and added to it a 2nd solution of sulfuric acid in a little less water. Another 5 minutes to wait as I slowly rotated the ribbon of film in the liquid. Another wash as I counted slowly to 60 to make a minute. Now the clearing solution. 5 teaspoons of potassium metabisulfite dissolved in 1/4 of water. It was now safe to switch on the room lights. The opaque silver halide, the part of the film that would eventually become black, was now a creamy yellow in colour, like images daubed onto a ribbon of transparent glass with Mrs. Mallet's abominable custard. By reflected light, these images appeared to be negative, but when I held them up in front of the white light, they looked suddenly positive. I could already make out what seemed to be a distant view of Buckshaw, a yellow, aged Buckshaw, like a dwelling from a dream. Now for the reversal. I held the whisk up at arm's length until it was about 18 inches from the white room light, then rotated it slowly as I counted to 60. This time using a variation on a method I had learned while studying artificial respiration in Girl Guides, before being sacked, unjustly, by that organization. 1 cyanide. 2 cyanide. 3 cyanide. And so on. The minute flew by with surprising speed. At the end of that time, I removed the film from the whisk, turned it over, and similarly exposed the other side. Time for the coffee again, what the manual referred to as the 2nd developer. The yellow objects in each frame would now become black. 6 more minutes of dunking and dipping, turning the whisk to be certain that all parts of the film were equally immersed in the reeking liquid. The 4th wash, even though it took only 60 seconds, seemed an eternity. My hands and arms were becoming stiff from the constant rotation, and my hands smelled as if they had been... well, never mind. No need for a fixer. The bleach and clearing solutions would have already removed the reduced silver from the 1st developer, and whatever silver halide remained had been reduced to elemental silver by the second developer and was now forming the black parts of the image. Easy as Cottleston pie. I let the film rest for a few minutes in a tray of water, to which I had added alum for hardening purposes, in order to make it scratch-resistant. After a time, I pulled up a length of the film and peered at it through a magnifying glass. My heart skipped a beat. The images were heartbreakingly plain. In frame after frame, Harriet and Father were seated on a picnic blanket in front of the Folly on the island in Buckshaw's ornamental lake. I turned off the room light and let the film sink into the water, leaving the dim red safe light as the only illumination. Not because it was necessary, but because it seemed somehow more respectful. As I have said, I trace their initials in the water. H.D.L. Harriet and Haviland Deluce. I was not able, at least for now, to look at their faces in anything other than light, the colour of blood. It was too much like spying on them. Finally, reverently, almost reluctantly, I removed the film from the water and wiped it clean with a bath sponge. I carried it out into the laboratory and hung it up to dry, draping it in great drooping festoons from the framed table of the elements on the west wall to the signed photograph of Winston Churchill on the east. In my bedroom, waiting for the film to dry, I dug out from the pile under my bed the disc I wanted. Rachmaninoff's 18th Variation on a Theme by Paganini. The best piece of music I could think of to accompany the recalling of a great love story. I wound up my gramophone and dropped the needle into the spinning shellac groove. As the melody began, I seated myself, knees drawn up under my chin, in one of the window seats overlooking the visto, the long overgrown lawn upon which Harriet had once tied down her de Havilland gypsy moth, Blithe Spirit. I fancied I could hear the clatter of her engine as Harriet lifted off among the swirling morning mists, rising up above the chimney pots of Buckshaw, up above the ornamental lake with its Georgian folly, and vanishing into a future from which she would not return. It had been more than 10 years since Harriet had disappeared, killed, we were told, in a climbing accident in Tibet. 10 long, hard years, nearly half of which Father had spent in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. He had made his way home at last, only to find himself wifeless, penniless, and in grave danger of losing Buckshaw. The estate had belonged to Harriet, who had inherited it from Uncle Tar. But because she had died without leaving a will, the forces of darkness, as Father had once referred to the grey men of His Majesty's Board of Inland Revenue Department, had been hounding him, as if, rather than a returning war hero, he were an escapee from Broadmoor. And now Buckshaw was crumbling. 10 years of neglect, sadness, and shortage of funds had taken its toll. The family silver had been sent up to London for auction. Budgets had been trimmed and belts tightened. But it was no use. And at Easter, our home had finally been put up for sale. Father had, for ages, been warning us that we might have to leave Buckshaw at a moment's notice. And then, just days ago, having received a mysterious telephone message, he had at last summoned the three of us, Feely, Daffy and me, to the drawing room. He had looked slowly from one of us to the other before breaking the news.
"Your mother," he said at last, "has been found."
More than that, she was coming home. Chapter 4. I realized that ever since Father's shocking announcement, I had been shutting myself off from reality, shoving the facts into some kit-bag corner of my mind and pulling tight the drawstring, in much the same way as you would try to trap a tiger in a sack. Although it is shameful to admit, I knew that I had been trying to hang on to the past, attempting to awaken every morning to my old world. A world in which Harriet was still comfortably missing. A world in which, at least, I knew where I stood. I was grasping at every chance to avoid change in the same way a drowning man tries to grab at his own rope of bubbles. Not that I didn't want Harriet home. I did. Of course I did. But what would it do to my life? The finding of the film had been a godsend. Viewing it, I thought, might provide a new window into the past, a window that would help me see more clearly into the future. This was one of those troublesome thoughts with which I had recently begun to be plagued, new, raw, and still not entirely to be trusted. It was like thinking sometimes with someone else's brain. It had something to do with being almost 12, and I wasn't sure I approved of it entirely. I darkened my bedroom by covering the windows with quilts, fastening them to the frames with drawing pins round the edges. Buckshaw's shabby and threadbare draperies were not nearly enough to keep out the sunlight. In the laboratory, I had given the film a sharp flick with my fingernail. A hard, satisfying tick indicated that the same sunlight had dried it completely. I had wound it back onto its spool and brought it to my bedroom. I threaded the film into the projector, which I had set up on my washstand, and pointed the projector into the fireplace. The walls of my bedroom were covered with such vile Victorian wallpaper, red clots on bilious blue, that there was no blank surface upon which to project the developed cine film. Fortunately, Mr. Mitchell, who was an expert in such things, had once told me, during a film night at the parish hall, that a white projection screen is not really required.
"Everyone supposes it is," he had told me, "but only because they've never seen a black one."
He went on to explain that a projector will provide those shades which are missing from a screen, that in fact, while watching the latest Ealing comedy in the cinema, those parts of the screen which appeared to our eyes to be black were actually white.
"Aye, white, but unilluminated," he'd said. Well, that made sense, and it seemed logical to me that the vast flat brickwork at the back of the fireplace, blackened by eons of soot, would provide the perfect surface. And I was right. As I switched on the projector and twisted the lens to bring it into sharp focus, the image on the fireplace bricks was formed of luxurious velvety blacks. Here was a view of Buckshaw, as seen from the Mulford gates, moving now along the avenue of arched chestnuts towards the house. Next, a closer view, Harriet's Rolls-Royce Phantom II, parked on the sweep of gravel near the front door. Then came a shot of Harriet, seated in the cockpit of Blythe Spirit. I recognized several of the statues in the background as those which now, more than a decade later, lay strewn in ruins among the overgrown hedges of the Visto. Harriet grinned at the camera, and seizing the sides of the cockpit in both hands, boosted herself up and swung her feet out onto the aircraft's lower wing. "Harriet, my mother, moving and breathing, as if she was still alive, and even more beautiful than I could have imagined. She seemed to glow from within, illuminating the world and all that was in it with the radiance of her smile.